All right. If you're ready, we're ready.
I'm ready.
Good. Talking to Gabriella Coleman. So what exactly is a hacker?
In the most general way possible, let me start over, actually.
Sure.
So a hacker, you know, when you say the name, invariably, I think a couple of, you know, images of a kind of criminal breaking into a computer immediately comes to mind. But when you look at hackers, you know, historically, sociologically, anthropologically, you see basically computer aficionados really, really dedicated to the craft of computing. And that's what a hacker is in a kind of very general sense. But then
isn't it? Because it changes the way you think about them. I think you're right. People say hacker and they think it's somebody who's trying to break in and make a mess of things.
Yep, cause some sort of malicious damage. And it's certainly the case that there is that type of hacking, and there's even, you know, a kind of transgressive tradition in hacking, which is, I would say, illegal, but not necessarily criminal as well.
Now, you're an anthropologist, which means you're interested in the culture of hackers. Is that a fair statement?
Definitely, and especially their ethics and politics. That's what really drew me in more than anything else.
How'd you get interested? How did it start?
It started by learning about a license called the copyleft. It's really a class of licenses which really work in a very distinct way from copyright. Basically, they grant access to users to access, modify, and distribute software. And when I had learned that the copyleft had been invented by these free software hackers and was not only in use, but was what was being used on most of the internet, I was interested. I was surprised. I was like, okay, here are a bunch of technically minded computer folks who had basically reinvented the law. And that's when I delved in.
It's interesting. I've never heard that term before. And you say it's in widespread use now, copyleft?
Yeah, there's a lot of pieces of software, such as Firefox, which is a web browser, or Linux, an operating system, and then, you know, the sort of plumbing of the internet, web servers and send mail. All of these pieces of free software are licensed under a free software license. And now there's other kind of licenses, such as the Creative Commons licenses, which were inspired by free software, which are used for things like music, art, and books.
I think what I like about it is that I've heard of all of the open source and of people wanting to share, but copyleft has a kind of humorous flip on copyright that says something about the people who use it, doesn't it?
That's absolutely right. What's so fascinating about the world of hacking is that on the one hand, it's a craft and you follow tradition when you're a craftsman or craftswoman. But hackers are crafty as well. They don't like to follow rules, tradition, whatever has been handed down to them, whether it's a technology, norm, or law. They kind of like to push the boundaries and maybe reinvent it, poke at it. And they often do it in a kind of humorous, clever way. And the copyleft precisely captures that.
Yeah. Now, you have actually gotten to know this firsthand. You spent, 3 years living with hackers in San Francisco?
Yep, 3 years. And I had done some research before and after as well online.
And this was just kind of when you were getting started with this. You had actually done some work on hackers for your academic studies. But this is kind of a different flavor, isn't it?
It is for anthropologists who have tended, especially if it's your first project, to sort of leave your home country, go somewhere far away to do your initial research project. And I decided to, as I say, stay home. But I did find a very unfamiliar world to the one that I was used to.
I was going to say, you left your home country in the sense that these people, they're not completely different from everybody else you know. In fact, many of them may be people you know. But the culture is different from everyday society, isn't it?
No, that's precisely right. And it's interesting. It was a friend of mine who had kind of clued me into the copyleft, and I had known him for quite a long time. And he had sort of kept that not, you know, hidden as a secret, but he just didn't think I was necessarily interested in it. And it's definitely the case that what they do is not necessarily available or necessarily transparent to the rest of the world. Although this was one of the interesting parts about my research is they're definitely committed to certain ideals like free speech, which do have broader currency.
In fact, in your book, Coding Freedom, you say at one point that the hacker world was the place where the culture of civil liberties was on fire. That's a pretty strong statement.
It is. And, I stand by it still. I still see it well and live and kicking. And I think it really hit me at a certain point when about the, 10th, 11th, 12th hacker was quoting Ben Franklin or Thomas Jefferson, and then, expanding on that to talk about the loss of civil liberties today. And that's really when I was like, okay, these folks are not simply building technology, but are really quite committed to certain strains of civil liberties in a very active way.
Did it surprise you to discover that when you lived among them?
It really did. It absolutely did. As an anthropologist, when you're doing your dissertation, you have to come up with a proposal and you have to do some research. You have to know something before you leave. And I had delved in, and it was really only when I had gone away and really started living and talking with people where it finally struck me that this was, unusual and important.
Did it feel like something you felt you should have known?
Yes, I think it is only because technology and software is so important to what we do today. A day doesn't go by when someone doesn't log on to the internet or use a piece of software or their computer. And yet what I find as a professor is that, students really lack basic technological literacy. What is source code? They don't know the underlying directions of software. What's encryption? When you secure either communications or software. And hackers who really know this stuff are a wonderful, wonderful window into that world. And so can be very convenient to kind of get students more literate in the technologies they use every day and which have huge political ramifications.
I'm just curious, do you speak tech? Do you talk tech? Do you know open source? Do you know source code? Can you program?
So when I started doing research, it was pretty clear that unless I took some programming classes and system administration classes, I wouldn't know what was going on. So I took two programming classes, Scheme and Python, and a basic system administration course. And this was absolutely essential. At the same time, the folks I studied and perhaps what makes them hackers is that many of them got involved in computers from a very young age, 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, I found. And their level of technical skill, knowledge, and literacy is one that I, as an outsider, could never command. But I had to learn enough to be able to even follow conversation and ask intelligent questions.
What's fascinating, I think, is to the outside world, people who know source code, who live inside computers, don't seem to be the kind of people who would care about the things that you've discovered the hacker community really does care about, this whole business of copyright and copyleft, of consciousness of the legal implications of what they're doing. And in fact, you suggest that they may be more acutely conscious of the legal implications of free and open source software than anybody else.
No, absolutely. And it's interesting because I make the argument that for many of them, they come to law and politics to protect their productive autonomy, their ability to exchange knowledge, share, build better technology. Over time, they come to care about broader issues that sometimes exceed just their technical craft. But what's so interesting as well is that I think their technical skills transfer over to the legal realm. So they become quite adept at reading the law, understanding the law, and making the law. That doesn't necessarily mean that they'd be good lawyers, because there's a lot of skills that are non-technical that go into being a good lawyer, but nonetheless, those very technical skills help us explain why they're so easily have been able to embrace the law and make that part and parcel of their craft today.
What impact do you think this has had on the way hackers approach their work? I mean, this battle about intellectual property is a pretty serious battle. Has it changed the way they approach what they used to do?
I think, you know, it's interesting. It's certainly the case that in many instances, hackers don't want to care about the law. You know, that's actually something that gets in the way. And what's fascinating is that the birth of free software as an idea in 1984, which was kind of imagined and dreamed up by Richard Stallman, he didn't imagine it in legalistic terms. He wanted to get away from the law. It was only because of a big controversy that he had to turn to the law. And I find it's certainly the case that a class of hackers really still have that distaste for the law. It gets in the way from what they really want to do. While others, on the other hand, kind of enjoy it, the kind of technical wrangling, the little details that matter. And because hackers are quite diverse, it allows for that kind of diversity when it comes to approaches to the law.
That diversity is really important, isn't it? Because there's a lot of money in software and in the internet, and some people have it and some people don't. These people, many of them do, I don't know, but they certainly could have money, and yet they seem to care more about the rights issue than about the economic issue.
Well, again, when it comes to hackers, it's they're even those that are committed to free and open source software, because there's other hackers who are very pro patents and copyrights as well, especially, you know, in Silicon Valley and in other regions. And then free and open source software developers, for some, it's about the moral rights. And for others, it's about the kind of practical elements. Most believe they should be paid for what they do. And then many, though, believe that you shouldn't cordon off knowledge for the sake of profit, because that will get in the way either of your freedoms and your rights or good software, better software.
And this stretches well beyond the computer community, the software community. This is an idea that goes into all parts of our lives. So you're studying just a bit of the strata.
That's exactly it. I mean, hackers come really in many packages and sizes, and they're engaged in different technical crafts. So, for example, the world of encryption, hackers who write privacy tools, for example, is a whole other world of hacking. Those engaged in security, and they call themselves InfoSec hackers. There's a kind of transgressive tradition who've definitely broken the law and, you know, derive pleasure in transgression. It's really worlds upon worlds upon worlds, and that doesn't even touch the kind of international dimensions as well.
Such a serious subject, but I keep thinking back to copyright and copyleft, and you can hear a smile in the voice of whoever came up with that. In fact, you've written a whole chapter on hacker humor. Forgive me, it's a pretty serious part of the business, isn't it?
It is, and it's hard to convey the humor always. And it was that was really striking to me. I was like, wait a minute, there's so many jokes here, both, you know, when they're interacting with each other and even in their technical artifacts, they embed what they call Easter eggs, which are little jokes to each other. And I really then knew that this was something important and that I had to write about. And it actually took me a while to really think about how to approach the topic of humor, which was just simply so prevalent in the hacker world.
It sounds as though it's hard to see the joke sometimes.
It is. If you don't have the kind of technical background and knowledge, it's really just not going to come off as funny at all.
Is there a joke you could tell those of us who are not hackers that we would find funny? Or is it so serious that it doesn't communicate well outside the community?
I feel like it's pretty hard to communicate it. I will say this, though. I mean, I think the moment where I was really struck as to why humor was distinctive was this. I was at a conference. It was a fairly serious conference. It was a technical conference. It was populated by hackers. And it's certainly the case when, you know, any speaker gives a talk, they will often, you know, break the ice by telling a joke at the beginning or throughout. Well, it's very apparent that something was different when it was clear that hackers can interrupt the speaker to tell a joke. And this would happen all the time. And I was like, okay, I bet comedians do this at their conferences as well, maybe. But aside from comedians and perhaps mathematicians who tend towards humor as well, this is when I really noticed that something quite distinctive was going on.
So they're hacking into the keynote address.
Absolutely. They will not hold back if there's something funny to say, especially clever.
Well, there is a kind of... I'm not sure exactly what to call it. There is a community that's living and breathing that isn't just numbers. Maybe that's what it is. But where it leads is to things that are not just technical efforts, but moral efforts. I was thinking about, I'm not sure how you say the word. Is it the Debian Project?
Debian.
Debian Project. The Debian, well, tell me about the Debian Project.
So Debian is a flavor of the Linux operating system because Linux can come in different flavors. And it's currently a project of over 1,000 individuals located all over the world who work together to make sure that this operating system works and works well. And what's so fascinating about Debian is not simply that they are dispersed and can produce a high-quality product. It's just how complicated of an institution Debian is. They have a social contract and a constitution and guidelines and very complicated voting procedures. And this was also astounding to discover.
It's almost like the building of a country, isn't it? It was just a few people at the beginning, and before they let it grow, they established a moral basis on which it was allowed to grow.
Exactly. And there was moments that there was definite growing pains, and people said, okay, this is not working. What are we going to do about it? And it's, again, really kind of ironic because a lot of these technical people would you know, if you ask them, they'd say, oh, we're not good at this social stuff, you know, building a kind of organization. But in fact, you know, those who decide to partake, because not everyone has to partake in the building of the organization, those that do have come up with very clever processes and procedures.
Are these the kinds of processes and procedures that could translate into a different world from the Debian Project?
I think it can. I definitely think it can. And in some cases, you know, Wikipedia is a good example of a project that has some of the similar policies and procedures as well. And both projects, you know, on the one hand, have a kind of group of people who have to really follow those. And yet there's another layer of openness where you don't necessarily need to follow those mandates to participate. I think part of the trouble is that there's sometimes this idea that these projects are simply ad hoc, peer-to-peer, extremely loose, and then some people go, okay, let's just follow that element, and don't realize that introducing forms of friction, of social organization, can sometimes be quite a healthy thing for the life and especially reproduction of a virtually based project.
What happens in the Debian Project if somebody does something that is not an accepted practice?
So, for example, there was this one time where technical guardians presented an idea that made it seem like it had been a decision. It was unclear. Was it a decision or was it a proposal? And any big change by technical guardians, even though they're kind of allowed to make it, really they have to consult the project at large. And so when they had presented something that seemed like a decision when it was in fact a proposal, they kind of got eaten alive. And there was a big debate, and it was then clearly transformed from maybe a decision into a proposal. And then when it comes to other suggestions or elements, there's, you know, very well laid out procedures by which to do this. For example, bring a general resolution to the whole project and idea. Shall we allow non-technical people into Debian? Is they brought to the table a few years ago, and the project decided yes through voting.
That's a big change.
That was a big change.
Yeah.
Came late in the project.
It's interesting that it came so late. I guess not surprising because there is such a strong technical bias in all of the hacker community. But still, it's one that has laid the groundwork for changes in other parts of the community as well, hasn't it?
No, absolutely. And it's definitely a community that, on the one hand, prides itself on its kind of openness and meritocracy. But there is this kind of strong strain of elitism where technical knowledge, skill, and chops is definitely valued more than anything else, for better and for worse.
You've spent a lot of time writing about Anonymous, another organization of hackers. Although maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe it isn't just hackers. You've even started writing a book about this. Isn't that right?
Yes, yes, and I'm so glad you mentioned that. I mean, what's so fascinating about Anonymous is precisely, on the one hand, hackers are essential to the building of what are different networks and different nodes and different groups sometimes who sit in a lot of tension with each other. They set up communication infrastructure, and they're the ones with the technical skills to engage in the hacking operations. Yet, on the other hand, unlike a Debian, it truly is kind of open. You know, whoever wants to show up on the internet relay chat channels to contribute, whoever wants to call themselves anonymous can call themselves anonymous. So it has this extremely fluid, open, participatory dimension to it that some other hacker projects do not have.
Now, on the one hand, that would be great, of course. Everybody join. Come on. We're all together on this. On the other hand, it means you're sitting there and the name you use for yourself gets used by somebody with whom you may have serious disagreements.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because the different networks actually have distinct political cultures. So one of them, which protests the Church of Scientology, they no longer use something like a distributed denial of a service campaign, which is, you know, sending too many requests to a web page and it renders it inaccessible.
Yeah, there have been a lot in the news lately about efforts to bust up the daily operations, at least, of specified organizations.
Exactly. And other networks embrace this tactic as well. And then occasionally there's an action in the name of Anonymous that then all the different networks go, we don't agree with that. You know, okay, someone can call themselves anonymous, but it's pretty clear that it's a kind of lone individual acting.
This must be fascinating for an anthropologist to look at. This is exactly what you went to school to study, isn't it?
It is. It is. Although I never, you know, dreamed that I would, you know, come across something as weird and strange and hard to study as anonymous.
But this, it also has to be hard to study something that weird and strange. I mean, it's like going into an island community where you don't know the language.
It is, and it's also the case that because some of the networks engage in illegal action, secrecy is, you know, part of that world. There's also a lot of misinformation as a kind of tactic to protect themselves or just to play as well. And so you're kind of entering a certain minefield or labyrinth, and it's very difficult to ascertain what's true or false. And this was very different compared to Debian, which was built on these ideals of transparency and access.
Do you keep wanting to, keep expecting to turn on your computer and see the joke's on you?
Yeah, definitely, you know, have developed certain forms of paranoia through this project, of different flavors as well.
In the book, you say that you think of Anonymous as both visible and invisible. Is that because some parts of it insist on staying hidden and some don't?
That's exactly it. I mean, it's fascinating. Anonymous is something that has landed on, you know, magazine covers. The mask has been, you know, taken up by rabble-rousers and protests all over the world. It's on CNN, Russia Today. It's just has this enormous visibility, keeps popping up in places you don't expect it, like a rape case in Steubenville, Ohio. You're like, what? On the other hand, you know, for example, the largest Twitter account, Your Anonymous News, which is about to establish a kind of news site, has never granted one interview to the media. Who are these people? They're hard to access. Once they get arrested, they become unmasked. But otherwise, it can be quite difficult to really understand who they are and who they are behind the mask.
Because there are so many different kinds of people involved in Anonymous, are they really hackers? I mean, the Debian community started with real technical foundations. And maybe you can say that of Anonymous, but it sounds as though it's grown well beyond that now.
Absolutely. You know, there's really a good, I would say great majority of individuals involved don't have very deep technical skills at all. That's really a small portion. There's another portion who have, you know, what I call like digital literacy skills, are really good at, you know, creating a well-produced video. There's definitely those involved. And there's those who, you know, their skills are organizing skills. They're good organizers. It's hard to organize hackers. They're like cats. They want to do their own thing. And so organizers who may have no technical skills are particularly important in Anonymous when it comes to, you know, getting things done.
But they bring a different sensibility. I keep thinking about the technical people and how you wrote at one point about their belief that source code is speech, which implies the whole First Amendment argument, that the free speech argument, and if source code is speech, then it ought to be free. And that's a sort of different thing from Anonymous.
It is. It is. I mean, Anonymous tends to rise up most forcefully when censorship on the internet rears its head. And so they're really involved in those cases, such as the Stop Online Privacy Act, which was a bill that was killed due to protests. They're also interesting because they kind of enact anonymity, I think, in a period when anonymity and privacy might be the way the dinosaur might be gone, you know, a kind of last breath, just because these are really kind of threatened on the internet for both technical and legal reasons.
It's harder and harder to stay anonymous, isn't it?
It is. It is. I mean, the internet and technologies, as they're configured, are really quite good at keeping digital footprints and keeping a really detailed footprint of everything we do in some ways. And so what I find so interesting about Anonymous is precisely the fact that they remind us of the lack of kind of anonymity that kind of exists today.
On your Wikipedia page, it says you've been influenced by Lewis Hyde, which I assume is his book, Trickster Makes This World.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I love it.
Do you see Anonymous? Do you see hackers as tricksters?
I absolutely do, in so many different ways.
Do you see yourself as a trickster?
I don't know. You know, an anthropologist actually does move between worlds. You know, they have to broker between the academic world, and they get really involved in the world they study. And when you move between worlds, when you broker between them, it does put you, you know, as a boundary crosser in a kind of trickster position. But within the world of Anonymous and hacking, it's pretty full-fledged at some level. They're, you know, pushing norms and boundaries, and as a result, kind of renewing, you know, culture in the ways that Lewis Hyde talks about or writes about.
How do you see this changing? I mean, when you started this a few years ago, your community, the anthropological community, didn't know what to make of you because this wasn't the kind of anthropology most academics would pursue. Now, with the hacker community, with Anonymous, with the Debian Project, groups like Firefox and Linux, so widely known if not understood, it's kind of opened it up. Or am I wrong about that?
No, it definitely has opened it up, and there's, you know, more researchers than ever diving into these worlds. Open source has been incredibly well studied. using, you know, different methods and paradigms. It is the case when you get into more illicit worlds in hacking, it's much, much harder to study for all sorts of reasons. Academics don't have legal protection. You know, it can take years to build the connections and trust to get into certain arenas. So I suspect some parts of this world, you know, are just going to be studied very slowly, very piecemeal.
The documentary maker Brian Knappenberger said about Anonymous, he's done a doc about them. He said that future anthropologists will see you as a kind of early explorer. Is that how you see yourself, as an explorer?
Definitely. It feels like an adventure, one in which you don't know what's going to happen next. I like to use the word errantry to kind of describe the research into whether it was open source or anonymous. And I don't think that adventure is going to go away anytime soon.
And it's clearly an adventure that still excites you.
Most days.
Well, Gabriella, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You were great.
Oh, great.
Well, thanks again. This was great.
You're welcome. Okay.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.